One of those tracks is called White Levi's, and you can still go on the internet and look for White Levi's Jefferson Airplane, and you can hear Grace Slick crooning about the 12 different colors that White Levi's come in. And it's so psychedelic, the sound. It just sounds like the 60s, and it's San Francisco in the 60s. And that's one way we tap into it.
I'm Michael Gloster, and this is Fashion Cast. We're talking to fashion leaders and disruptors as we seek inspirational stories and expert insight into the world's most dynamic industry. Heard in over 70 countries, we're building an international fashion community based on fashion topics that matter. Please visit our website, fashioncast.co, to join our email list and learn more. Now, enjoy the show. This marks the inaugural episode in a series dedicated to prominent American fashion brands as FashionCast commences its observance of America's 250th anniversary. In this episode, listeners are introduced to Tracy Panic, historian at Levi Strauss & Co. Tracy holds both undergraduate and graduate degrees in history and, since 1995, has served as corporate archivist and historian across various organizations. She joined Levi Strauss in 2014. With the company's establishment dating back to 1853, Tracy occupies notably one of the most distinctive roles within the interesting fields of history and fashion in the United States. Tracy Panic is joining FashionCast from San Francisco, California. Welcome to FashionCast, Tracy. We're so excited to have you here.
It is my pleasure. Excited to be here.
Yeah, you know, you've got a very unique position, and I just want to know a little bit more about your background and how you kind of ended up in this position as historian at Levi Strauss Co., which is just so cool. I can't stop thinking and talking about it. I just love that position. So anyway, let us know how you landed at Levi.
Yeah. So I have a graduate degree in history. So I'm one of the few people who studied history who actually gets to use it at work. And I also, in addition to getting my master's degree in American history, I also interned during my master's program at the California State Archives, which has a fabulous collection, not so many garments, but I learned about archives philosophy in a hands-on way. And then when I started my first job out in the real world, I was working for a high-tech company that launched cellular service at the Los Angeles Olympics in 1984.
Okay.
And then from there, was there, and as often happens with big companies and tech companies, they merged. And so I went to from cell phones to cars. I started working for the AAA, the Automobile Club, here in Northern California, which has a very interesting history going back to the turn of the century, 1900s.
Really? Okay.
They were all about helping to make driving cars more easier for people who first had vehicles and good roads, and creating signs on the roads before Caltrans even existed. So I went there, was there for 15 years before this position came open, when one of my good friends who was working at Levi's retired, and she had established the archives there. So I've been at Levi Strauss & Company as the historian since 2014 and loving it.
So you traded cars for jeans, essentially. Yeah. But you are also, aren't you also the director of the museum, the Levi Museum there?
Yeah. So along with being the historian, which means what it sounds like, I do historical research, writing, interpreting things. I also manage the Levi's archives, which is an incredible collection of pieces, especially clothing, garments, that goes back to the 1870s when the company first started manufacturing its own products like the original Modern Blue Jean. And I also manage the Vault Museum, which is our headquarters museum in San Francisco.
And how big is the museum?
Well, the I don't recall square footage wise, but let me say that it's been closed since COVID. We had a museum before COVID closed us down, and then we've reopened, and it's now three times larger. So if the space that was the original museum is now three times larger. And if you're talking about a corporate, a company in San Francisco, that's like amazing to have that much real estate. So it's right on the ground floor, and folks can come in from the public and come into the museum for free without having a business reason to come into Levi Strauss & Company.
Yeah, and it really looks like it's curated very professionally. I saw some pictures online. It's really the white glove treatment, so to speak. So
absolutely.
Yeah, it seems so interesting. You could spend a lot of time there. What about Levi Strauss? If you could just talk up to the audience a little bit about, you know, this German immigrant. When did he immigrate into the United States? And, you know, what was his initial thinking with regard to the fabric, you know, the blue jean fabric?
Well, Levi, as you've pointed out, was an immigrant to the United States. He came in the late 1840s, came through New York, as many people do. He had a couple of older brothers who were living in New York and had a dry goods wholesale business in Manhattan. And he learned about what that meant and how you operate and the kinds of things that you sell. And then he heard the siren call of the gold rush that was happening on the West Coast. And he decided that he wanted to expand the family business by heading to the West Coast. I imagine it also gave him the opportunity to do this under his own name without his being in his brother's shadow. So he comes out to San Francisco. It would have been a very adventurous time. There's no transcontinental railroad. He comes on steamer down to Panama, crosses Panama. There's no canal at that time, and takes another steamship up to San Francisco. It's a month-long trip. He arrives in 1853. It's March. It's rainy. And one of the first things he needs to do is look for a warehouse near the waterfront, where we still are very close. We're close to the waterfront still today, because he's expecting a shipload full of supplies from his brothers in New York within a month. And he is in San Francisco in California, not to look for gold. He's going to set up his business and sell to those who have flooded into California and San Francisco, sell products to them as a dry goods wholesaler. So he's not making these products yet. That'll come later. And he becomes very successful very early on. Within those first 10 to 20 years, he becomes a very well-regarded and well-known salesman. And I'll tell you one little fun trivia, a little piece of trivia.
Okay.
So if you come to visit us at Levi's Plaza, which is what we call the headquarters, which is near the Embarcadero, adjacent to us and across the Embarcadero is the cruise ship terminal. So you can actually come to San Francisco on a cruise ship and then walk across to our headquarters.
Oh, neat, neat.
But yeah. If you do, you will walk across and you'll see a big water fountain, and there's a granite rock formation that's there. Underneath there are the remains of a gold rush era ship. We were our headquarters is literally built on the foundation of the gold rush, because there were so many ships coming in. Many became landfill for a growing waterfront. And that's just a fun little fact about coming to our headquarters.
Wow, that is really interesting. Do you know how old Levi was when he embarked on this journey from New York to San Francisco?
Yeah, so he was still a young man and would have arrived here in his 20s. He was born 1826, 29. I'm losing track now. But a month before he leaves for San Francisco, he becomes a naturalized American citizen. So when he arrives in California, he's an official American, and really his story becomes the American dream story, building a business that I don't imagine he would have anticipated becoming as successful as he was, and being able to create that business and stay in San Francisco and do very well.
Yeah, it's really a remarkable, kind of a crazy story in the sense that, you know, Levi Strauss has become so successful. One of the things I wanted to ask was, as a historian, you know, I think people are thinking, okay, maybe she doesn't have a fashion background, which half the people in fashion don't have a fashion background, right? You know, because not everybody's a designer. So what's your daily kind of schedule as the historian at the Levi Strauss Co.?
Yeah. No, I'm not a designer, but I work with a lot of designers. My daily work, it varies. It's part of what I love about what I do. I answer questions from employees, fans who will get in touch with me and want to know about their grandparents or their father's products. I work with designers are the biggest users of the archive. So I spend a lot of time with designers who
really okay. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. In the archives, and they look at those historic pieces for inspiration for new products. One of my favorite recent ones is a Toy Story collaboration that we did to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the movie. And we took some of the designers, when creating those products, took an early cowboy image that we had called the Saddleman, which was a cowboy dressed in Levi's with a saddle over his shoulder. And we added that to the back of some of our products, but it was a Woody version of the Saddleman.
Okay.
And then of course we put, you know, Levi's jeans on Woody. So that's an
fun
example. But, so I'll work with designers. I do a lot of work trying to look for new pieces to add to the archives. So the hunt, the search for pieces is part of what I do. And that can be at auctions or taking care of people, getting in touch with people who might have things that we can get. And then also keeping and maintaining a repository of stories, Levi's stories around the world, so that we know who wore our products, where, how, and what cultural moments might intersect with those stories.
So how many pieces are at the museum?
Well, there's the museum and there's the archives. So the museum, which is the vault, it will have a small number of things on display, but the archives itself, there are thousands. So on site, we have 1,000 plus boxes of garments and other things, mainly garments. And then we also have an offsite location because we have lots of things that can't fit all in our space. And we also have two cars. We have a Levi's branded Jeep and a Levi's branded AMC Gremlin that we can't possibly fit inside the whole space in San Francisco. Yeah.
That is so funny. Yeah. And so then are you just changing out the exhibit so often and just using these different pieces?
Absolutely. So this the debut exhibition, which we opened the 5th of this month, November 5th, and it runs through December 18th. It's called Amped Music Icons on Levi's Denim. There are 9 extraordinary pieces from music starting in the late 1960s and going up to present. It includes Levi's garments worn by everyone from Beyonce to Elton John, Freddie Mercury, Justin Timberlake, and Britney Spears, and the like.
One of the things I love about Levi Strauss is it seems that they're never outdated. And I know, just doing a little background research, there seems to be a very strong history of innovation within the company. And, you know, I don't see that at every company. You may see that at tech companies, you may see that at some manufacturers where the workers are incentivized to innovate and, you know, they may get a bonus or something. They may get credit for a patent. But what is going on at Levi? It just seems to me, or am I kind of going down the wrong road? There's not a strong culture for innovation, but it seems like there is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Innovation is super important. Let me just start by saying we're going to be 175 years old in 2028. Which is pretty remarkable for an American apparel brand.
Is this the oldest American apparel brand?
No, we're not the oldest. We're among the oldest, but to last as long as we have and remain relevant.
God, I can't believe that someone's even older than that.
And one of the things I sometimes say, and sometimes at Levi Strauss will say, we are the youngest, oldest brand in the world. And part of what we mean by that is it has to do with innovation and staying relevant. How do we use our legacy, certainly not in a stuffy old way, but to reinvent ourselves? A great example of that is our recent campaign with Beyonce called Reimagine, where we've taken several classic Levi's advertisements and remade them with Beyonce using her own music. So that's an example of how we're innovative. Our first product began as an innovation. Levi working with one of his customers in a collaboration to create the first riveted denim pants or modern blue jeans. And we continue to innovate. We actually have an innovation lab. It's called Eureka. And we create prototypes and work on things that will help us come up with some more innovative products as we move forward. But definitely that's part of the culture.
The Eureka Lab.
Yeah, you're like Eureka. You found it. Yeah.
That's fantastic. That I love that. Eureka. Every company should have a Eureka Lab.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that. So initially, the Levi jeans began as workwear for miners, for cowboys, for laborers. When did Levi shift from just making workwear into the kind of casual fashion? I will say initially, I think it was casual fashion. You could probably argue that jeans are more than casual today, but nevertheless, I'm just coming from that angle. Where was the line of demarcation from workwear to casual fashion?
Well, that's a big jump. So let me start, Michael, by saying, 1873, Levi Strauss & Company and one of Levi's customers, Jacob Davis, receive a U.S. patent for riveting pockets. It's called an improvement in fastening pocket openings. And it's all about creating a really tough pair of pants that can be worn for workers. And those original customers were blue collar workers. They were, as you pointed out, cowboys, railroad engineers, miners, farmers, and the like, who needed tough outdoor pants. And that innovation with the rivet is what made them so strong. And then the addition of really heavy duty, strong denim and fabric that could last a long time. So for the first 50 plus years, it was all about those workers wearing them. The first hint we get that there might be a shift from not having simply practical workwear happens in the 30s. It's not like there was just one moment ever, but one hint we get happens in 1935, Michael, and it happens when an article comes out in Vogue magazine, and it's an article about going on a vacation to a dude ranch in the American West. And it was very popular in the 30s and 40s for people in the East and even as far away as Europe to come to the American West and stay on a working horse or cattle ranch. And if you came, according to Vogue magazine, you had to dress like a cowboy, a dude or a dudeen. And so they recommended getting a pair of Lady Levi's. At that point, we had introduced the first blue jeans for women just a year before. They recommended getting a pair of Lady Levi's, a Stetson cowboy hat, boots, a kerchief. And if you had a great air of bravado at the dude ranch, you could have a great time if you were dressed like this. So here's the first first instance when people are dressing to look like a certain part. And it's more about style than it is about practicality, like a ranch hand or a farmer would need to wear tough Levi's.
Okay, so that makes sense, 1935. And leave it to Vogue, right, to kind of dream this up and drum this up. And, you know, I'm surprised they didn't ask for some, you know, payoff as part of this, you know, free advertising.
Those dude ranches became super popular vacation spot, and they were kind of echoing what was happening at the time. And it was during that era that we actually launched a line of Dude Ranch line and Western wear by 1937 to help take up that demand and need that was going on. Yeah.
Well, I love this Lady Levi line. That sounds. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like something that'd be cool today, even Lady Levi's. I mean, I'm not sure. What are you calling it today? What are you calling the ladies? Is it still Lady Levi? I've never seen Lady Levi.
So Lady Levi's we introduced in 1934 as a way to distinguish it from the men's because it was so unique. And in the 30s, women generally weren't wearing pants yet, and certainly not denim pants and blue jeans.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
But it took another couple of decades before it became acceptable. But we introduced them just to differentiate it. But by the certainly by the 50s, when it became more mainstream, you could get a pair of Lady Levi's or Lot 501. So the 701. So the men's were the Lot 501 jean or the original waist overall button fly jean that we manufactured beginning 1873, and then after we introduced the first Lady Levi's, we identified it as a Lot 701, and then we began giving them lot numbers just like we did our men's products.
Were some of those jeans colored? Did they have different colors, or were they still just the blue jean, the indigo?
Primarily, we're just talking about denim, blue denim. When you think about blue collar workers, denim is what they're talking about. So that those original workers and wearers of our famous overalls were wearing denim. It's not until really the 60s that there's an explosion of color. There's some attempts before then. 50s, we even did some color, but that was kind of a flop. It wasn't until the 60s when color comes out in a big way.
And we'll be right back with Tracy Panic after this brief message from Ome Organics Skincare. OMEorganics.com.
Hi, I'm Christine. You may know me as co-host of Fashion Cast, but I'm also the founder and CEO of Ome Organics. I believe skincare should be simple. Our hyaluronic cream is all you need to nourish your skin morning and night. Sourced from the highest quality organic ingredients from around the world and manufactured in an FDA facility right here in the USA, this incredible cream works to firm, deeply moisturize, and smooth the appearance of your skin. Please visit omeorganics.com and use promo code FASHIONCAST to receive a 15% discount off your first purchase, and you will receive our monthly newsletter free. Now, back to the show.
And we're back with Tracy Panic, historian at Levi Strauss & Co. You know, Tracy, just before we broke for that brief commercial, we were going to talk a little bit about the 60s. And, you know, I really want to know how the 60s cultural revolution in the U.S. changed the Levi brand.
Well, I think one of the things that is remarkable about Levi Strauss & Company and the Levi's brand is the ability to evolve and change over time, and also to be an observer of culture and to be to have what's going on in culture affect us in a very organic way. And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. So from the 30s up until the 60s, the company's main marketing focus was all about the cowboy and rodeo and sponsoring rodeo and making sure that our products were getting out to cowboys and so forth. But we're based in San Francisco, and of course we're going to be affected by what's happening in San Francisco. And our headquarters is just a stone's throw away from the counterculture, the epicenter of counterculture, Haight-Ashbury district, where hundreds of hippies are coming into the city, and we're observing what's happening. And we're noting how many young people are adopting denim, and it doesn't have to be brand new. They can go and get something that's been used, or they can go to the Haight and find something at the Diggers place where you can get things for free or exchange. And even if your Levi's have a little bit of a hole or some kind of a tear, you can patch it up or you can embroider it and you can make them your own. So what we notice as a company is these young people coming in, this rising youth culture and their adoption of much more casual clothing than their parents had worn, their parents' generation had worn. Levi's become one of those adopted clothes. And we also notice the interest in music. And so in 1967, that's the famous year of the Summer of Love, the company works with seeing what's happening, observing what's happening. We work with famed music promoter Bill Graham, and he is representing Jefferson Airplane. And in a famous all-night session at the Fillmore Theater on Geary Street in San Francisco, they record 12 tracks, and we give them products that we want them to be singing about. And we just give them a few product details, but leave it up to them to create their numbers. Of those tracks, we select 5, which will air on the radio in the spring of 1967. One of those tracks is called White Levi's, and you can still go on the internet and look for White Levi's, Jefferson Airplane, and you can hear Grace Slick crooning about the 12 different colors that White Levi's come in. And it's so psychedelic, the sound. It just sounds like the 60s, and it's San Francisco in the 60s. And that's one way we tap into it. We're observing what's happening in culture, and we are helping to bring that interest out. The 60s is also, knowing that young people are adopting blue jeans and our Levi's, we changed the name of our product, our prime product, overalls. Our 501s are called our classic buttonfly Levi's, and we start using the name jeans in our products, like our 505, which was introduced in 1967 with a zipper fly, because we're paying attention. So that big shift really helps us to start focusing more and more on youth culture and certainly on music in our first radio ads.
Yeah. Talk about right place at the right time. You know, here you are headquartered in San Francisco, right there in the middle of the cultural revolution at Haight-Ashbury. That's unbelievable. And then you're smart enough, people at the company at that time were smart enough to, you know, kind of glum onto what was going on within the culture. And I don't want to say take advantage of it. I mean, but they were just smart enough to kind of cater to that and market to it. So brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And of course, if you look at old Woodstock pictures too, for the people that do have clothes on in Woodstock, they all seem to have jeans on, you know, Yeah, so
they do. We like to say it was a sea of denim. And one of the pieces, by the way, one of the pieces that's on display in our museum is a piece by John Sebastian. He was famous for his tie dyeing, and he played impromptu at Woodstock wearing a white tie-dyed Levi's jacket. John Sebastian of the Love and Spoonful. So yes, by 1969, young people dressing in Levi's and denim, and just an explosion of color at that time.
Where is that jacket? I want that jacket. Is it in the museum? Tell me it's not gone.
Sadly, it was auctioned off, but we didn't get it. A couple of years ago, that jacket was auctioned off. But back in maybe 2016, I went and visited the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland.
Yeah.
And I got to see that jacket.
They have it. Okay.
Well, later years, more recently, it was auctioned off. So I imagine it's in a private collector's hands right now. But yeah, the other thing we have, and we had on display a few years ago, is a pair of 501s that was worn by one of the attendees at Woodstock, who was actually photographed near the stage at Woodstock wearing a pair of Levi's. But you can tell what they look like because he had a pet owl, and he painted an owl on his Levi's, the leg of his Levi's,
okay,
and on the hood of his Oldsmobile station wagon that he drove to Woodstock in. And you can see him kind of laying back in the crowd, and you could just make out the yellow on the leg of his Levi's.
So you know it's those jeans here.
Exactly.
That's brilliant. I love that. What is your favorite Levi story? It sounds like, you know, as a historian, you probably know a lot of these different stories. is there one that you just keep going back to and saying, geez, I just can't believe this particular story?
There are so many stories, and it's part of what I get to do. Stories like meeting a woman a month after I started the company who found a pair of Levi's in a mine in the 1940s and then donated them to us, and they've been in our collection. In fact, we keep them in a blue fireproof safe, and they're called Calico. But I have to tell you that one of the more surprising stories to me to learn about was, it happened in 2016. I got a tip that Christie's in London was going to be having an auction, and there was a Levi Strauss piece that was going to be auctioned off. Well, it turned out that this was a leather coat, not a denim, but a leather coat. We also did leather products. The leather coat was purchased by Albert Einstein. Yes, Albert Einstein, the Nobel Prize winning physicist, when he immigrated to the United States and was becoming a naturalized American, he bought the jacket of an iconic American brand, which I think is so fitting. And I happened to be in London for the auction for something else. We were part of we had some pieces on display at the Victoria and Albert Museum the same week the auction happened. So I got to go and bid on the Albert Einstein jacket in person and made the winning bid.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. Okay. So we have in our archives, we also have the jacket, a leather jacket worn by Einstein. And what's amazing about the jacket is Einstein smoked a pipe, and the jacket, along with having this beautiful leather scent, also has the scent of a faint scent of pipe smoke that you can still smell on the jacket. And we do a line of clothing called Levi's Vintage Clothing, and they're reproductions. So I work with Paul O'Neill, the designer who does the reproductions. And one of the things that we've reproduced is the Einstein jacket. So there are some of those out there, and you can buy a little piece of history. But I have to say, that was a surprising and amazing story to me.
Oh, yeah. That's an incredible story. I mean, what are the odds that you would win the bid, too? I mean, they must have loaded you up, you know, and said, hey, whatever it costs, Tracy, just get that jacket back here. Yeah, it sounds, well, that's nice to have Levi behind you. You know, it's weird because I think I just was, I honest to God, I thought I saw a picture recently with Einstein in the jacket. Have you got any picture? Yeah, and I thought
he famously said he only needed one coat. And he was pictured wearing it on the cover of Time magazine in 1938, plus a number of other photos of him wearing the coat are around. It's part of what was amazing.
I think I saw him wearing the coat with Madame Curie, and they were out like near a little lake, and someone had just happened to see them and asked for a picture, and he was smoking the pipe, and he had the... So it was a really rare picture. Wow. That's incredible that you guys have the jacket. I'm happy. Now you just have to work on this tie-dye jean jacket.
There we go.
So that's interesting, because that's a nice segue into at what point. So we kind of know when, you know, 1935, this casual thing kind of creeps up into Levi. And then the 60s really, you know, they start catering to a younger crowd. At what point did Levi's really become this international brand?
Yeah. Well, you know, it happens over time. And I have to say, you know, a lot of our history is a shared history. So as a company, you can certainly create things and create products, but it's the people that wear them and what they do in them that really also help to create our history. And that's what's so amazing about them. And one example of that is that by the 50s, we like to say that's when denim became dangerous, because that's when so many people in motorcycle clubs will start adopting Levi's to wear them. And then you've got Hollywood people like Marlon Brando wearing them on screen in The Wild One, in a pair of 501s and a leather jacket. The move to becoming global and going overseas, it starts to happen during World War II, when a lot of American GIs who aren't dressed in their uniforms are wearing Levi's and a t-shirt. And they're in places like in serving in the Pacific Theater, in Japan and the like, and in Europe. And so for a lot of Europeans, a lot of people in Asia, they're seeing Levi's for the first time. By the time the war ends, there's now this kind of introduction to it. Interestingly, in 1947, in France, in Paris, there is an all-American fashion show. And, you know, Europe is recovering from the war, and a group of American manufacturers, Levi Strauss among them, charter planes and head to Paris for this all-American fashion show. And you can imagine what it was like in Paris. Well, Americans want to show off their products, so they're going to be a lot of couture dresses and gowns. But among those fashions are two identical twins from San Francisco. Their names are Pat and Priscilla Emery, and they're wearing Lady Levi's and our satin rodeo shirts. They've got cowboy hats on, and the music is very Western, and you can imagine the kind of scene that created. Well, quite a stir.
They stole the show. They stole it.
Stealing the show, 1947, and you start to see this introduction of Levi's products overseas. We don't officially, as a company, create our international division until 1965, but it had been happening before then, and we'd been doing some exporting before then. From the late 40s on, and even selling our products on military bases. You could get them Levi's at PX shops, military shops. So hopefully that's a little bit of an insight as to how we go global. By 1972, one of the hallmarks that I will refer to is Life magazine comes out with an article, and it's titled, "The World is Blue Jeans Country Now." 1972, and there's pictures of people wearing Levi's in France, in other parts of Europe and Asia, and of course all over America. But the fact that that Life magazine created, and then along on the second page of the article is a picture of the Levi Strauss factory in San Francisco here on Valencia Street with the note "Where it all began," and our president at the time pictured next to it. So. Yeah, that's some insight.
That's so impressive. And that really makes sense. It's just a natural transition because of the war. And of course, wars in general, you know, spread different products around the world, for better or for worse. But in this case, for Levi's, it was for the better. That makes a lot of sense. I love the fashion show story. Yeah. That's so crazy. I love that story.
Me too. Two identical twins from San Francisco. That's part of the fun. And we have pictures of them. Yeah.
One of the things that happens when stuff is, you know, starts to, you know, leak out and go international is you get this competition issue. And we see that today where, you know, there's proliferation of imitation of products. There's probably some, you know, legal things going on. I'm certain that Levi's probably been caught up in this to some extent, but can you talk about that? I mean, how competitive is it, and how, you know, constrained or restricted are you in terms of that brand and the patents related to Levi?
Yeah. Well, the patents don't last forever, but the trademarks are super important. So we've had competition from the very beginning. When the original 1873 patent for riveting expires, we have competitors immediately. In fact, a lot of the litigation where we learn about some of the origins of the birth of the modern blue jean comes from that litigation. Today, of course, we have the same kind of thing on a global basis. So protection of our trademarks is super important. One of the things that we created back in 1886 when we knew our patent was expiring is our famous two-horse trademark. It's two horses with a pair of our overalls in the middle. The horses are facing in opposite directions, and it is an example of the quality. It's a picture, and it helps to reinforce the idea of the quality of our pants. They're so strong. Even if you tried to, you couldn't pull them apart. That trademark, which we created in 1886, is one of the oldest continuously used trademarks in the world today.
Really?
We guard it vigorously, And in the archives, one of the things we do is help with help legal with anything that comes up that we need to protect. And usually we can go back and look at something when it was first used, how long it's been used in order to safeguard that. So it's an important part. It's not that we can avoid it at all around the globe, but it's definitely an important part of maintaining our brand and identity.
Yeah, that's amazing. And, you know, with 6 billion pairs of jeans being made every year, yeah, I think it would be quite challenging. But obviously, Levi has the deep pockets and they can defend their brand for sure and have.
Well, it's not just about the cost. It's about having a place like an archives where we can demonstrate, hey, we've been using that stitch that you see on the back pockets of our jeans since the 1870s. Here's an example I can show you from our blue fireproof safe in our archives. So it's demonstrating that we've been using it all along because we can document that and chronicle it from pieces and from documents in our archives.
No wonder you are the most important person at Levi Strauss these days. Protecting the brand, yes. Yeah, all that stuff is obviously, I mean, in a way, it's more than just to come on in and look. You are. It's important for the company to protect the brand. That's amazing. That's just another twist on what you do. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. Your knowledge of Levi Strauss and this company, you know, we're just talking about, this seems to be unmatched. How do you think Levi Strauss would view the company's present state if he were alive and well and kicking today?
Well, I think he would be amazed and surprised. We have very few images or documents from him. That's due to the San Francisco earthquake and fire in 1906. But one of the few photos that we have from one of his descendants, they gave it to us. Levi is very casual in this one. He's outdoors. He's wearing a straw hat. And there's a little bit, it looks like he's greeting someone, and there's a little bit of a smile on his face. Well, that would be the beginning of what I imagine he would be looking like if he learned about how long and successful his almost 175-year-old company was. There'd be a great big grin on his face. I don't think he could ever have anticipated how successful it's been and how his name has been used all over the world.
Yeah, Levi equals Americana, and that's part of this series. It truly is the American iconic fashion brand. It's just an unbelievable story. And you've been just fantastic in explaining it.
It is. And one of my favorite, there's a lot of different photos, but one of my favorite photos is from 1989 when the Berlin Wall was falling. So during the Cold War, Levi's were banned behind the Iron Curtain. They were a symbol of America and Western imperialism, and you could only get them on the black market or if people brought them from West Germany or the like. When the wall fell, there are some amazing pictures of young people climbing atop the wall. What are they wearing? Well, they were wearing what they weren't supposed to at during the Cold War, blue jeans, Levi's and blue jeans. And it's just an amazing symbol of freedom, of the roots of American democracy, seeing these young people on top of the wall with that. As we get ready to celebrate the 250th anniversary of America, I think it's appropriate to be talking about American brands that really help share that ideal and that Americanism.
Yeah, that's a beautiful vision. I can see that in my mind. And I'm going to do some research on that and just see if I can't see some pictures of that. That makes sense. That's unbelievable too. Tracy, where can our listeners find you?
Well, I narrate a series on TikTok called The Greatest Stories Ever Worn and from the Levi's Archives. You can find me on YouTube. I'll narrate some of our Levi's YouTube channel and the Levi's TikTok channel. If you follow LinkedIn, you can see some of my posts there. And I also do some of the stories on the Levi Strauss & Company blog, Unzipped. So you can look for some of the stories that I write there. Thanks for asking.
Wow. You are a crazy, busy woman for sure. and very passionate. I love your passion for what you do. And it's just an amazing job that you have. And I'm kind of jealous, Tracy. I'm kind of jealous. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, it's been an honor and a pleasure, Tracy Panic. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for appearing on FashionCast.
My pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for listening to FashionCast. To hear more shows and join our email list, please visit our website, fashioncast.co. You can also join us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download your favorite podcast. Until next time, I'm Michael Gloster for FashionCast, the voice of fashion.